It's Wednesday, November 11th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, it's been a historic week at the University of Missouri. We're going to spend the next half hour or so talking about what's happened here this past week, these past few months, and really the role that the media has played in that. Monday morning, Mike, I was in your class talking with you and your students about what happened over the weekend when one of our students interrupted me and told us all Tim Wolf had resigned as president of the University of Missouri system.
I am resigning as president of the University of Missouri system today.
Change comes from listening, learning, caring, and conversation. And we have to respect each other enough to stop yelling at each other and start listening and quit intimidating each other through either our role or whatever means that we decide to use. Unfortunately, this has not happened. And that is why I stand before you today and I take full responsibility for this frustration and I take full responsibility for the inaction that has occurred. Use my resignation to heal and start talking again, to make the changes necessary, and let's focus on changing what we can change today and in the future.
That at 10 o'clock Monday morning, after what can only be described as a long, long weekend, and an even longer week before that, Friday night, a group from the Concerned Student 1950 group confronted Wolf after an event at UMKC and asked him for his definition of systematic oppression. Twitter user Kiana Jade posted this.
I will give you an answer. I'm sure it will be a wrong answer.
What do you think systematic oppression is?
Systematic oppression is because you don't believe that you have the equal opportunity for success.
You don't believe you believe.
Did you
just blame us for systematic oppression, Tim Wolf?
And from there, a movement that had grown over months literally caught the world's attention overnight. It brought down the university system's president. It led to the stepping down of Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton. It's a student movement that had a tremendous level of impact. It takes a lot of organization, a lot of commitment, a lot of leadership.
I think the students, this has been going on since last fall, after Ferguson. I think it goes back to Ferguson. And the things that we've talked about for over a year and a half here on this show and all over mid-Missouri, especially here in Columbia and on campus, I think it spread once, number one, that video went out. But even before then, when Jonathan Butler made the decision that he was going to go on a hunger strike, I think that began to move the story away from campus, away from Columbia, and out into the national dialogue. And then once, you know, Tim Wolf made those statements and the MU football team, or the African-American players on the MU football team, made the decision that they weren't going to play and participate in any football-related activities, including the game this weekend at BYU, I think that's when the governor, the board of curators, even Republican and Democratic legislators around the state begin to say, well, wait a minute, we have a serious issue on that campus and it needs to be addressed.
And I don't know that we'll ever be able to know, of course, what was cause and effect and what were the most important factors in leading to what ultimately occurred. But I have to say that even though a lot of the attention, especially nationally, focused on our football team.
And we're going
to
talk about that.
You know, we're going to get into that. But I mean, I think that video that you showed from the students in Kansas City, the video that was shared on social media, the video that's very authentic looking, framed up the way it was from a student's cell phone, where he gave an offensive answer to a question, I think may have been as much of a precipitating factor as anything else.
I think so, too. And I think what compounded the whole issue, at least the issue surrounding the statements that he made there in Kansas City, was the written statement that he sent out after that, where he tried to clarify himself, which was also sort of insensitive to what the students were saying.
Well, so let's talk about the football team. There is no question that it played a pivotal role, arguably catapulting a local and regional movement into a national and international story. Saturday night, just before I turned in for the night, I saw a tweet from the Legion of Black Collegians that had two photos attached. In one, more than two dozen football players, all black, standing with and behind Jonathan Butler. The other, a statement indicating their support and a promise not to participate in any football-related activities until Wolf was gone. That caught the attention of the national media, starting with sports-related outlets such as Deadspin and ESPN. And Sunday, head coach Gary Pinkel tweeted that the Mizzou family stands as one with a photo of the team and coaching staff. There are a lot of people that are saying that that decision by the football team to move forward starting Saturday, then moving Sunday, that was ultimately what pushed this and had the events that unfolded as quickly as they did.
I would say that it definitely was an impact. I agree with Mike that you really can't say that it was the mm-hmm. thing that caused the ultimate decision by Wolf to resign. But when you begin to talk about the football team not participating in football-related activities, including possibly boycotting the upcoming BYU game that's already scheduled.
It's going to be in Kansas City.
And so then that brings in the national sports media, because that's a big thing. You're talking about football, collegiate football players effectively going on strike.
Mm-hmm.
And this is for a social issue. And I think what people need to understand is that this is not the first time that sports has intersected in social movements and been a part of social movements.
Remind us about some of the other examples.
Well, you can go back to the Olympic athletes, mm-hmm. in Mexico City.
Yeah.
And their boycott. You can go to that. You can go to football players, specifically in the NCAA, where the University of Kentucky didn't want to play the University of Texas El Paso because they had all black players, and Kentucky had a strict we aren't going to play black teams rule back during segregation. So you can go into that. I mean, it is always there's oftentimes been this intersection between sports and social movements, and this is a time where we see that. But I think what makes this different is that in light of what's going on in athletics right now and the amount of money that is being spent and is being earned by colleges and universities and sports and players basically saying, hey, wait a minute, we want a piece of this action too, for them to show that they have power
mm-hmm.
on a social issue could also turn this into a, hey, we may have some power from an economic perspective as well. So, I mean, this has those kinds of ramifications, and you have other colleges and other athletes that are looking at collegiate athletes that are looking at this as well, because it's more than $1 million. I mean, that was just what would have been owed.
That's just what the university would have owned to BYU for breaking the contract,
right, but
to not participate.
Exactly, but you break that contract, but you had other contracts out there.
There's also the idea. I mean, ESPN is a media outlet, has a vested interest. This game is to be broadcast on the SEC network, which is a subsidiary of ESPN. There are a lot
exactly. The Kansas City Chiefs were involved. The Kansas City Convention and Visitors Bureau, and all the vendors. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was much more than just $1 million.
And I don't want to take attention off of the main issues the students were raising, but I have to say, from putting my cynic's hat on for a moment, I suspect that if you're talking about the lessons learned by university administrators, it had a heck of a lot more to do with, oh my gosh, we're open to the possibility of these student athletes using this power in ways that could have huge impacts on us. And it seems to me that, in fact, they really can do that. And coaches, more so than anybody else, are having to learn how to interact with their athletes and support their athletes in ways they really didn't have to do in the past.
I've read on social media, and I've actually been asked by other reporters who've been doing stories on this, whether or not if the football team was had a winning season, would this have happened?
We have no way to know that.
It's
not a winning season. We don't know what would have happened.
Right.
You can't.
No, you're absolutely right. But I would want to believe that the football players saw this as more than just about football.
Mm-hmm.
They took a stand in support of their fellow students. And I think oftentimes what comes up missing when we start talking about collegiate athletics is that they're students, they're student athletes. So there is a connection between the athletes who are playing on the field and on the court and the students who are actually going to school here, because they sit in classes with them and they talk to them and they interact with them outside of the athletic part. And I think that's where that connection comes into play here.
There's that human interaction, that social circle.
Yeah.
How many times on this program have we talked about the idea of the media parachuting into different cities during times of breaking news, be it a mass shooting, a natural disaster, what have you? Well, I guess you could say this week it was our turn. Columbia, Missourian photojournalist Imani Cobbs shot this shot of satellite trucks and other news vehicles lining Conley Road alongside the Carnahan Quad. Just about every major national news media organization was represented, either by full-time staffers, freelancers, or in some cases, our students hired to cover the story for them on a per diem basis. What types of things did we see and experience with the national media descending upon us?
I mean, I actually didn't pay as much attention to the national media this time as I normally would, because there was so much going on with our own local media. But this is the kind of story that they could not ignore. It fit into the entire narrative that they've been covering post-Ferguson, post-Freddie Gray, Black Lives Matters. I mean, all of that, this story fit in so perfectly with that narrative that they had to come and tell it. But actually, it did fit into that narrative. It wasn't an exaggeration. I don't think the national media oversimplified the story or sensationalized the story. I think this story deserved exactly the kind of national treatment it got.
I think you're right in that respect. I think some of the language and words used by reporters are the words that you see at the bottom of the screen
on that crawl type of thing.
I think that some of that was problematic, because one of them had, I think CNN had on that it was a revolt.
All Day Monday, yeah, that there was a revolt.
That there were these clashes and confrontations and that
Paul
sort of
Revere.
Thing.
Faculty have canceled classes when some faculty had canceled classes.
Right. I think the language and the verbiage that was used was probably a little over the top, but I think that's what we've come to expect from the cable outlets. But overall, I think that the national media didn't over sensationalize the story in ways in which it could have.
One of the things that came up in my reporting class, or my editing class, I'm sorry, on Monday morning as we were talking about it with students. And in that class, I have students who are working for KOMU, for KBIA, for the newsroom here, and for the Missourian. And some of the frustration that they were feeling was that following the weekend's events, that the students and some of the faculty who were involved in the activities at Carnahan Quad were shutting out the local media and choosing to only speak with the national media.
You know, that and a lot of other things, I think they kind of learned along the way that there were some of their strategies that didn't work out so well. That was probably one of them. Another I'm sure we're going
to
talk about in a few minutes
is
our, you know, clash with photographers. But I think that our students hadn't been under that kind of a microscope or in that big a situation before. And they had, frankly, some folks advising them who probably weren't giving them great advice either. But they did learn over time that those were not good approaches.
And the journalism students that I was talking to, they felt this little bit of resentment that there were students and faculty involved with this movement that knew who they were, knew where to reach them and how to tell and share their stories a year ago around homecoming, around September 11th. But as soon as this became a national story, that the local media was being passed over for the national.
Well, and a lot of that may have to do with who's actually reaching out to those faculty. I know I can just talk about myself in that instance, is that I was getting calls, mm-hmm. Not only from local, but also from national media. And I tried to talk to as many as I could, even though I was involved in other matters, teaching my class, dealing with students, that sort of thing. So it's I don't think that, at least I haven't heard that any faculty members that I know of didn't reach out to our own students. But I think a lot of faculty members were sort of sitting back going, you know what, I'm going to wait until somebody comes to talk to me before I engage, and I'm going to be very careful about how I do that. So I wouldn't want to go out there and say that it was intentional. Mm-hmm. I would hope that it wasn't intentional on the part of our faculty and staff.
Oh, well, I don't know that it was necessarily mm-hmm. an issue with School of Journalism. Right. I can't yeah. speak no, for I'm others, I'm talking specifically to about a reporter from KSHB who was told on the Carnahan Quad, if you're not with a national news outlet, we're not going to be talking
well,
to
if
you.
Well, if that's what an individual faculty member wanted
somebody
to
on site
somebody on site
do.
Wanted to do, that's their own privilege. But that may go back to what Mike was talking yeah. about in terms of, you know, faculty who aren't usually talking to the media, not really understanding how that process works.
Okay, well, by now, I'm sure just about everybody has seen the video that shows an interaction between a group of the Concerned Student 1950 supporters and photojournalism student Tim Tai. Tai.
Yep.
Students, can you tell him how
you
much
you don't have a right to take our photo?
If you would like to take photos, you need to please give them space. Do not, you cannot be this close to them. Please.
They're being close to me.
What I'm saying is, you need to move back. Yes, you are.
Job to do. I'm documenting this for a national news organization. Yes, I can. This is the First Amendment that protects your right to stand here, protects mine.
You're not going to yell at her?
Just calm down. You're not going to
Okay, ma'am.
She doesn't want you.
The First Amendment, ma'am, don't yell at me, ma'am. The First Amendment protects your right to be here and mine.
So he was on assignment at the time for ESPN. I have to tell you, hearing those words, the First Amendment protects your rights and mine. As a member of the School of Journalism faculty, I couldn't have been personally more proud of how he conducted himself, how he kept his cool, and how he explained the situation in a way where he was trying to defuse it and justify his presence there and how and why without elevating the situation. Other people around him may have, but in my eye, he didn't do anything to add to it.
No, I mean, I share that. I mean, I think that he tried to explain that his rights actually not only dovetailed with their rights, but he was trying to tell their story. It starts out simple, okay? Mm-hmm. And you think, okay, he's on the right side of the First Amendment. The students are not right. But it quickly evolves into something that's a heck of a lot more complex. Again, I think Tim did the right thing. Applaud him. The journalism school as a whole defends what he did. But there were even some other reporters that were unsure whether or not him getting into that was ever going to make any difference. I mean, we have one of our reporters from KBIA, Bram Sablesmith, who wrote a piece on KBIA's website basically saying, I whispered in his ear, there's nothing to gain from this. And I think maybe everybody standing back now could say there was something to gain from it. We had a learning opportunity, had a good conversation. But I don't think anything good was going to come at the moment from that confrontation.
Yeah, and I've actually had conversations with many of our students and who are actually, some of them were out there covering it and doing some other things. And one of the things that they said was, you know, look, at the time, if you're trying to tell someone else's story, if you're trying to cover that event, if you're trying to talk about it, the last thing you want to happen is for you to become a part of it. And in the moment, it may have been better if he had stepped all the way back and figured out another way to tell that story. I agree with you, Amy, that I am proud of the way in which he defended, you know, the way he tried mm-hmm. to explain what he was doing to say that, hey, the First Amendment gives me a right to be here, but it also gives you a right to be here. I agree with all of that. The problem becomes at the time, in the moment, you are being recorded and you become a part of the story and you're not able to actually do your job. So that's why I think that was some
issues. That raises an interesting point, Ernest, because leaving work Monday night, you and I had a quick conversation in the parking garage about how one of my students stood up in class and reminded everybody that if they were going out and they were going to be covering this, to remember the real people who were there and to remember that everybody who was on that patch of land had some kind of personal story or personal connection that brought them there, and to remember that and to view each person in their humanity. And this is one of those examples where everybody's emotion was elevated, and perhaps to take a little bit of that step back and see how that might further drive emotion.
I guess what I ultimately appreciate about this circumstance mm-hmm. is that although this is like a lot of other events that have happened recently around safe spaces and triggering warnings and Halloween costume advisories and all that stuff, it did end differently here mm-hmm. than it has ended at some other places, including a very high-profile case at Yale University. In the end, the students took down those signs saying, you know, the media aren't welcome. The faculty member who got into a lot of trouble nationally and with us about what she did, the communication department faculty, she issued a public apology. The staff member from Greek Life issued an apology late last night. And I think everybody's just kind of standing back now and realizing that we need to have a more reasonable conversation. That doesn't always happen when we get into these kinds of debates.
And I also think what's come out of this is a more broader look, or a more complete look at the First Amendment and what that really means. Because those of us in the press, we talk a lot about the First Amendment, but oftentimes we're talking about the freedom of the press. Mm-hmm. And in this situation, you had not only the freedom of the press, but you also had the freedom of assembly, the freedom to protest, the freedom of speech. So you had all of those colliding in some very fundamental and profound ways. And now we have an opportunity to talk about the First Amendment in its totality and get journalists to understand that it's not just about freedom of the press. You have to look at all of those, and you have a responsibility to uphold not only freedom of the press, but also all of those other freedoms that come with the First Amendment.
Having said that, though, I don't want to take the focus off of people who increasingly seem to believe that for the sake of tolerance, that they're being so intolerant. There's a really interesting article that the media critic Connor Friedersdorf wrote in The Atlantic, and I'd suggest you take a look at it. And it's actually called The New Intolerance of Student Activism. And it really has some disturbing, you know, notions there about what we mean by the ability to have a free and open exchange mm-hmm. in a university climate. There are so many things working against that right now that we have to try to do something about.
No, I'm in agreement with you. And I think one of the things is that, you know, there's so much on social media, and our students and not just our students, but this generation and a lot of people have gone to social media to try to have these kinds of interactions. The problem is, you know, people think they can be anonymous and they
civility
can
breaks civility down breaks down in, exactly. in an instant.
It breaks down in an instant, and it really causes that sort of discourse that you're talking about, that understanding what does intolerance mean and how can you have those conversations. Oftentimes they don't happen on social media because people feel like they can say anything without thinking about how that impacts someone else.
I have seen a lot of misinformation going around on social media and some other places. And maybe this is because I live in the echo chamber of having so many journalists in my Twitter feed or in my Facebook feed. And I'd like for us as faculty members here at the University of Missouri and at the Missouri School of Journalism to be able to explain and clarify a little bit about what a courtesy appointment is and how that works. And because we've talked a little right. bit about, and there have been some statements out there that the communications professor right. who's at the center of this and at the end of that video doesn't teach journalism here, but because in so many other settings at other universities, journalism and mass communications are in a single school, that is a nuance that's been lost elsewhere.
Well, and at the doctoral level, advising students who are doing sort of heavy research, they have privileges on our faculty as our faculty have privileges on theirs because they're working on doctoral committees together and research projects together. So those kind of courtesy appointments are fairly typical. But it should be clear that, you know, Melissa Click was not a member of our faculty, but that doesn't mean she didn't have interaction with our graduates.
Yeah, she worked with many of our doctoral and our master's students on their dissertation research and on their thesis research. Many of our students took classes in the communication department in which she was a faculty member and taught some of those classes. No, she did not teach any classes within journalism, but there was those kinds of interactions. But in terms of that's basically what a courtesy mm-hmm. appointment means. And we just don't have it in communications. We also have people who have courtesy appointments from public policy and from history and from other areas.
So we have seen some headlines where it says like, the journalism professor has resigned. That's not exactly what's gone on there. There is some inaccuracy.
Right, there's some inaccuracy there, but I think part of it also is that on our website, on the School of mm-hmm. Journalism website, there was some ambiguity about what a courtesy.
It's jargon that we understand that the audience
exactly,
may not.
Exactly, the audience doesn't understand, and other journalists don't yeah. understand it.
I've got to say, too, before we get off the social mm-hmm. media angle, just how damaged people's lives are from just being subjected to the kind of comments that have come from social media. I mean, start with our students of color first who are out there, then the football players. But Tim Wolf, who people may not feel is a sympathetic character, but, you know, he's got a life to live. And the social media exposed him to some abuse that otherwise wouldn't have happened. Melissa Click, same way with her.
Yes, yes.
Janna Bassler, same with her. And even, I will say, Hunter Pack, the student from Rolla who was arrested for the vile and insensitive sort of threats that he made. He's 19 years old, and what social media are doing to him is going to make it very difficult for him to overcome this too.
So then let me ask you, where do we go from here? Where and how do the storylines develop? What do we do to heal? Where do we go?
Well, I think in light of everything, one of the opportunities that we have now is we now have some space in which all sides can come together and talk about what kind of an environment, what kind of a culture we want to have here at the University of Missouri. We say we want an inclusive culture here at the university. Now we have an opportunity to decide what does that mean, what does that look like, and what do we need to do in order to be able to create that. So I think now we have that opportunity.
And frankly, I'll say that I think in the vast majority of cases, our students are way out in front of the faculty in terms of having that conversation. I mean, I think they have some lessons to teach us about the way that we deal in this media environment today. So it isn't just that we've learned some things we can impart to our students. I think they're already ready to teach us.
And I also think, you know, that we need to start, and I think Dean David Kirpius said this over and over again yesterday, is that now we need to start talking with each other instead of at each other. And I think we've been, for the last year and a half, there's been a lot of talking at each other and not listening and not trying to understand and not trying to work to sort of build that kind of culture.
I have to agree with that. And I think that's on the student-to-student level. I think that's on the faculty-to-faculty, faculty-to-staff, vice versa. And I think that's also on the faculty-to-student and vice versa.
Yeah.
We have a lot of work to do here to move forward. Well, we are just about out of time today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics that we talked about, some of the reporting that's been done over the course of the last 10 days or so. That's on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. We also invite you to like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch our program again, ask us comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next week and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show. Maya Jackson is our technical director. KBIA's Pat Akers is our audio engineer, and Sue Lay is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Thanks for joining us. We'll be with you again next week for another edition of Views of the News.